Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, June 18th, 1996. In the Creekside Room this morning, our speakers are David Messenbring and Maria Jimenez, continuing their series on maritime ministry. Today's session is number 6 and is titled Law or Gospel, Church and Seafarers' Rights. Let's listen in.
This is Maria Jimenez, and we will together do a session called Law or Gospel, the Church and Seafarers' Rights. It's a follow-up to the session we did yesterday called A Church in the Workplace. And yesterday we explained to you how maritime ministry is an evangelical, ecumenical, multicultural ministry in the workplace that is justice-oriented. And today we take the fifth part of that, the tenet, the justice tenet, and really look in particular at the kinds of rights work that poor chaplains get involved with, largely because they're the only people who see the problems. You can't establish them. We don't think you can build a whole ministry around just doing the seafarers' rights cases. Seafarers, it's interesting, they constantly live with the knowledge that they're vulnerable and that terrible problems could hit them at any time, but they don't hit them every day. So we established our ministry around the daily needs that people have, helping them make the phone calls and put postage on the letters and do the counseling, the kind of thing that people need every day, so that we would have contact with tens of thousands of people. And when a problem struck a given ship, then they would know where to turn. And thanks largely to the great reputation that Maria has, I'm going to embarrass her a little bit here and say that thanks largely to her good reputation, that strategy has worked. The General Secretary of the North American Maritime Ministry Association likes to tell the story of meeting a seafarer up in the Northeast somewhere once who carried in his wallet a laminated copy of a photocopy of Maria's business card. And he hadn't needed to use it, but he kept it with him so that if he ever had a problem, he would know how to get a hold of somebody who would help him. Now the question we're going to struggle with here, I hope we'll struggle with it a little bit, and it's reflected in the title, Law or Gospel, the Church and Seafarers' Rights. And it's really a question of whether the church should be involved with such questions at all. In New Orleans a few months ago at the annual Gulf Coast Port Chaplains meeting which we attended, one of the chaplains, a Norwegian pastor actually, set off the only hot discussion of the whole conference when she suggested in a speech that we really shouldn't take sides in these disputes between the owners and the workers, the seafarers, that then we just undermined our relationship with the ship owners and the ship and the agents, and we needed them to help support our ministries, and so we shouldn't try and rock the boat by doing that kind of work. And as soon as she sat down, she got barraged by a controversy among the chaplains about whether or not this indeed was central to our work. So it is controversial, and we hope to deal with some of that controversy today, but from a perspective of sharing with you what it is we do. And Maria, who does that work for our agency, is the one that's going to do most of the talking here. I'm just introducing it, getting it started. She says, we'll see. She knows me.
Again, feel free to interrupt if there is any questions or something that I said is not clear. I have a little challenge with the language in English, but I hope we can communicate well. The type of problems that we hear more frequently are those related with wages, with contract, or with termination of the contract, or with illness or accidents. There are some other type of problems, but they're not as large in number as those that I've mentioned. To give sort of a base from what I'm speaking today, I have found in the Bible some passages that encourage us to take a step, take a position before the needs of others. I'm reading here in Psalm 9, verse 9, "The Lord is a stronghold for the oppressed, a stronghold in times of trouble." In verse 12, talks about, "For he who avenges blood is mindful of them, he does not forget the cry of the afflicted." And on verse 18, "For the needy shall not always be forgotten, not the hope of the poor perish forever." In Psalm 140, verse 12, "I know that the Lord maintains the cause of the needy and executes justice for the poor." In Matthew 7, verse 12, "In everything you do to others, as you would, in everything do to others as you would have them to do for you, for this is the law and the prophets." And finally, in Luke 1, verse 52 and 53, we read there in the Magnificat, "He has brought down the powerful from their thrones and lifted the lowly. He has filled the hungry with good things and sent the rich away empty." Those are pretty powerful words that help or encourage us to be on the side of the poor and the oppressed. I'm thinking about some stories to share with you this morning. The stories of the this is a ship that was in port for over 6 months. The name of the vessel is, or maybe it's been changed now, it's called Inagua Tania. We heard complaints from the crew that they were not getting paid. And they were from Mexico and most Venezuela. The crew were for these countries, and they kept hoping that sooner or later they would be paid. So they kept working with that hope in mind, and the company was giving them bits of money, but never paid them their full salary. I'm thinking about the first mate who was the most, who had been working the longer, who had been working on the ship, and was owed a lot of money, but he kept thinking, someday I'm gonna get my money. And if I don't work, if I stop working, this is the way I'm never gonna get paid, because the company is gonna be having more problems if the ship is not sailing. So they decided not to do anything. It was the day that the ship was arrested, because there were other creditors who seized the ship, and the ship went into a long process, legal problems in the court with all these creditors.
Can I just explain what the process of arrest is? That's probably unfamiliar. The first time she started using it, I didn't know what she was talking about, so I'm sympathetic to some of you maybe. When a ship, if a ship is commercial property, and if it has debts, there is a legal process in the United States whereby the vessel can be arrested by federal marshals. There's some chairs over here if you'd rather. But the party who feels they're owed money has to put up a bond, hire an attorney, who files papers in court, and then the federal authorities will come and, it's called arrest the vessel. And at that point, the vessel goes into a holding pattern controlled by the courts. and eventually can be auctioned off and the proceeds divided. But somebody has to take action, and in this case, not the crew members, but other creditors had hired the attorney and put up the bond, people who were owed money for.
Right. So even at the time that the ship was arrested, the crew were with fear of joining the claims of the creditors, and they're still hoping. And I was having a hard time trying to let them know that this is dangerous, because they could lose all their money if they don't file a petition before the court soon. So finally, they took their own search for an attorney. They didn't listen to what I had to advise, which is all right. I cannot push them. I cannot force them somehow do whatever I think they should do, because in the last analysis, is their own life, is their own families who are at stake, their own jobs, and that's very, very important. So they found their own attorney, and the attorney was not very experienced and filed late. So the case was already in process, and this attorney was not specialized in maritime law, so he made some mistakes. What happened then? They had to find another attorney. We have to involve some of the union representatives in order to put some pressure and to educate the attorney. So things were complicated, and these crew members never got paid. It's a lot of money, and still the case is in court because there was an appeal for the money of the crew. The ship was eventually sold, and the creditors got their money, but the crew never did. And as I said, the first mate, it was owed like maybe $20,000 or so, which is still he keeps calling from Mexico. What do you know about my case? Where is the money?
This was really the first 6 months of last year, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we still are getting collect calls from various parts of the world, from these guys who have gone on to work on other vessels, and we have no positive answer.
But it was done in the U.S. court?
Yes.
In the U.S. court by a U.S. judge,
yes.
And all?
Yes.
And the judge just ruled for the creditors and not for the crew?
Because the crew failed to put their complaint on time, and it was late, so the decision had been made before. But now there was an appealing to the judge, and that has been taken to Atlanta somewhere, and it's pending there for a decision. And I don't know, because the owner was in bankruptcy, so I don't know where the money is going to come and who's going to pay for the money. So now the lawyers are trying to negotiate with the new owner for some money, but it's not going to. It might not be as much as they were supposed to pay. So
there is an order, and crew wages come first. If all claims have been properly filed, then crew wages go to the front of the line in terms of who gets paid. But in this case, they didn't file properly, and I think a big mistake that the crew made was that in the end, didn't they try and initially hire the same attorney who was representing the creditors?
Mm-hmm.
Which is a big mistake, because he's initially hired by the creditors, and if he knows anything at all, he knows that the crew wages are going to come in front of his initial primary clients.
Well, but then the problem also is that they wouldn't have to pay the fees of the attorney. Usually an attorney gets a 40% of the claims of what is owed. So that means they're going to have to share half of their salary, and maybe it's $5,000 what is owed, so it's going to be cut. So they're trying to avoid the cost of the attorney. If there is somebody else that already sued the company, they can get it cheaper. That might have been the case.
Also part of it, right. It was a very complex case. Meanwhile, the ship, in order to save anchorage fees at the dock, was moored offshore, Amman, and the crew are stuck on this vessel with nothing to do for 6 months, every day wondering and worrying whether they're going to get paid or not.
Right, and we would communicate by radio, and it's limited the reach of the radio in our facility, so it was very hard to be in touch with them. They didn't have food because who was going to buy the food for them. We had to collect food, and
they fished.
The ship was in very bad conditions. They had all kinds of animals inside. And I remember one had to go in an emergency to the hospital because roaches had gone into his ears and had an infection in the ear. So it was a nightmare. But for them was very good to have us, because that was a safe haven, and they would get support from. So after that, we had a similar case, but the seafarers, this is the RoRo runner, a crew from Vietnam and Russia, and they have the same problem, not being paid. Then we act pretty quick, and they were, again, very scared, very afraid to be involved in any complaint, because they were going to be listed in their countries and never get a job again for what they did. That means go against the ship owner or the company. And these people were all 6 months or more again. But at that time, we had an attorney in our volunteer in our center who did the work pro bono. And it was good experience for him.
Yeah, but you're skipping some of the good part here. These are Russians and Vietnamese. So number one, they're scared to take action, to speak up for themselves in the first place, because of the cultural and political heritage that they're coming out of. Number two, the Vietnamese, we couldn't communicate with at all until she found the second Vietnamese translator that she found in the community, managed to establish a rapport with the crew, and then we could communicate through them. The Russians we communicated to through the radio officer and the captain, I think, were the only ones who spoke any English. And the word we get from them is, well, thank goodness the vessel has been arrested in a U.S. port, because this is the land of justice in the eyes of Vietnamese and Russians. And so we are sure that our case is going to be taken care of. And she tries to explain to them, well, you know, if you get your claim filed, how do we do that? With an attorney. What's that going to cost? Minimum 33%. No way. They no way were prepared to give 33% of their wages to a U.S. attorney, because they were in the land of justice where they were sure they would be taken care of. At that point, she went looking for a pro bono attorney and found this wonderful young man.
This is New York City?
No, this is
Fort Lauderdale. Daughter. Fort Lauderdale, Florida.
20
miles. All these stories are in Fort Lauderdale.
Yes.
You can multiply this by all the other ports. Mm-hmm. We're only talking about cases that we saw in the last 18 months in our port.
So after lots of works and hearings, luckily the hearing court went very fast, and the the attorney was very successful and was able to recover $160,000
of back wages and
repatriation costs and airfares. And people were happy, and that was a happy ending. But you see the difference between not taking action quick or taking action. But it has to be their decision again, because we are on the other side. At least they have to respond to their families and their future.
Go back to the first case again, where you said the boat, you know, from dockage, they had to get it out. Were they on that boat? Did I understand? They had no chance to get off the boat to get hired somewhere else? You had to provide food and everything for them on that boat?
Yeah, but they found their own attorney. One of the, I think it was the first engineer, was from Miami, and he knew some contacts. That's why he chose the wrong attorney, who we think is working for the company already.
Well, I understood that phase of it, but what prevented them from getting off of that boat and getting
the ship was arrested.
But he's saying, why didn't they just go take another job? Eventually, one by one, they started to leave and went home or whatever. Mm. But basically, if you've left home for a year at a time to support your family, and for the first 6 months you're sending money home, and then all of a sudden you can't send money home anymore for 6 months, you're going to go home after 6 months of not sending any money home with not a penny in your pocket? And who's going to pay? The ones who chose to go home on their own never did get repatriation costs, did they? I mean, they had to buy their own ticket to go home. Better to wait, and you're constantly living with the hope that maybe tomorrow, or maybe even this afternoon, the whole thing is going to change. And you know, every day you wait and you wait and you hope. And so to take that radical action, that if you can manage it, you know, if you can find the money to borrow to buy a plane ticket home, and then face your family when you get home with no money.
But also, it's not easy to find a job in a ship. Mm-hmm. You have to pay a letter of employment or some dealer in order for him to give you a job, and you need money to pay. So it's very hard to find a job. Very hard. That's why they take the first thing that they find, and they're inserting the quality of the ship that they're gonna find. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Would not the first mate and the engineering officer and the radio officer be a part of the management team of the ship under the captain, or are they just titles and considered part of the crew?
They're titles and considered part of the crew. They don't have anything to do with the management. The captain is the liaison,
okay.
But with still, he's involved. He's part of the crew, and he gets his wages. As another crew, unless it's a family of the owner and they share, and he's the only one that gets paid, and while the others don't, and so keeps a little bit more.
Well, when this ship, the first ship you talk about, when it was arrested and sent out to mooring, was the captain still aboard her then, or had
yes.
he already left?
No, the captain was on board. The captain was on board, and when the ship was arrested in mooring, they had a custodian, sort of a policeman, who would supervise what was happening there and would relay that to the company.
The custodian is a frequent thing we see, because technically these people don't have permission to enter the United States. And if the ship is just coming into port for 8 hours or 2 days and then leaving again, okay. But if a ship is... In this kind of a situation, immigration gets very scared that these people are ripe to jump ship and enter the United States illegally. Because, as you were saying, why don't they take another job? Well, the temptation is there to give up on this situation. You can't go anywhere else, so you just slip into the community, especially if you've got relatives who will wire you money to take a Greyhound bus to someplace. And so the custodian is appointed by immigration and paid for by the economy of the ship, to make sure that nobody leaves the ship illegally. And there was a little launch that would go back and forth carrying the custodian and not, but usually it was only the captain or the first mate who could travel on that launch and would come in for a few hours and talk with her about, you know, what should our next step be, and then not follow the advice.
Another case that happened recently after Christmas is the, you might have heard of it, well, maybe not. It was in the newspapers, I'm thinking, it's in the area of Mobile, Alabama. This is a ship that sunk out of those waters. And we had a phone call from one of the friends of the persons who died or missing.
Ship sank. Well, tell the story about how it was arrested.
Yes, I'm trying.
Okay. eight people died? Seven?
Seven people died. So this ship is sailing out to Jamaica, and we believe that it was overloaded, and on board there was a nephew of the owner. The owner is from Haiti, and it was very anxious to get the cargo into Jamaica because the ship had been detained in Mobile for a couple of weeks because it was unsafe to sail. So here I have the picture of the nephew of the owner rushing the captain. The captain is from Russia, Latvia. Run, and put more, and let's go. Because you can go straight and take less days, but face the wind and the waves, or you can go zigzagging. Of course, it takes more days. We think that might happen, that the nephew say, no, go straight and take, we already lost too much time. So the ship sunk, the Coast Guard is looking for these survivors for 2 days, and nobody, only one person from Guyana seems it was able to be alive. That person refers what happened a little bit. But the question here is that the friend of this missing seafarers was very concerned because the owner didn't want to compensate the families for their lives, of their husbands and fathers and so on. The only thing he was ready to do is pay 1 month wages. 1 month wages. And so again, we had to procure some advice and get some legal assistance to see what are the rights of these people, if the insurance would cover or what. That's the legal aspect. But we thought it was very unfair and very hard for the families back home not to receive any support of any kind for the life of their husband. Besides, nobody could produce a death certificate, so these families could go to their governments and apply for benefits. So where these people are, and who are the families? Were they notified or not about their loss? And still, we don't know about the others. There was an Indonesian, and there were three Guyanans and three Latvians. We know that the family of the Latvians were told because of the friend that was in Miami. But what about the others? So until there is the case is not seen in court, we won't be able to have that list of next of kinship of who are the families, because the company would not release that information.
In this case, one of the problems is the efforts. We have not been able to contact the one survivor who was picked up by the Coast Guard and brought to Tampa. And in Tampa, placed in the care of the company, the owner, who we consider to be at fault. As Maria said, the Coast Guard had arrested this ship for safety problems and tried to force repairs. Coast Guard has that right to seize a vessel and say, you're not sailing until X number of safety violations have been attended to. There was this very aggressive nephew of the owner on board who kept pushing everybody to let us go. You know, you're undermining our ability to make a living here. Every day we're in port, it's costing us a fortune. And 8 hours out of Mobile, it hit a storm and sank. Now, one survivor, and there are some reporters trying to do research on this, and we've been working with them, and nobody can make contact with the survivor. We don't know where he is. He was last seen in the company of the owner, who's Miami-based. But he would be able to tell the story of what happened in those last hours, and how did the ship sink, and then we would know whether due to one of the safety violations. But of course, the company doesn't want any information coming to light about how the ship sank, because if it can be proved, the company wants to say it was natural causes. It was a storm, bad weather. But we do have a photograph of this ship on the Miami River a month earlier, and you can see the cargo kind of hanging over the side. The ship was definitely, on that occasion, grossly overloaded. Seafarers die in, how many died last year? We should have that statistic. It's shocking. The safety condition, the number of people who die when ships go down. And one of Maria's big complaints is, how come if a commuter plane crashes in Indiana with the loss of
five
lives?
That's why I said you might have heard.
It's a national story. And ships go down every month with the loss of 20 or 30 Filipino lives, and we never hear about it.
Wait, why is that? Because must be, I'm just guessing here, must be something to do because it's tied real tight with Wall Street or something, you know?
I think it's because we could be on that commuter plane, and we're not likely to, none of us in our community are likely to be on those ships. The people who work on those ships are invisible, anonymous.
And it almost, the stories you've painted, it's almost like they're slaves.
Mm-hmm.
And doing business, so I know the Port of Seattle over here, in the Port of Tacoma, they really brag up the fact that they do business with X number of nations of the world, and oh, every year X number of ships visit our port and do this value of business with us. Nothing is ever said about the slaves that are rowing those ships into the bay.
There's a lot that isn't said about injustice, economic injustice worldwide, and it's simply a feature of the fact that we're in a global labor pool, and the people who are desperate enough for jobs to work on those ships don't count in our eyes. I mean, don't count enough to come to our attention in the way of major stories. Keep in mind that what we're talking about are the bad apples in the basket. There are a lot of good ones, and I wouldn't want to knock the whole industry.
Well, what countries are notorious for running slave ships?
I wouldn't say countries, but you can see some flags like Cyprus or Malta or some Panamanians, Honduran's flag.
They all come to Seattle. Everyone you said sails by our door there, and they're coming in and going out of Seattle.
And as soon as you go on board and see how the environment looks, you can feel how people are there, and they will, you know, you just sit there, a cup of coffee, and then you learn everything, and start talking about how long is your contract for, or you have a contract. Some of them don't even have contracts, so they're totally vulnerable to whatever they've been asked. So, but let me go to the next story, and you can see some other type of problems. This is about a woman working on a cruise ship. Women are considered a little bit of objects of, the ship is very hierarchical, and captains are little bit mini gods there. They do and undo things as they please. This woman was sexually harassed. She was asked to go to the cabin, and maybe for, she thought she had been intimidated. She had been told things very private, and she was scared and was forced. Not directly, but threat that if she was not going to the cabin, she would be sent home. That there were many people waiting for her job if she was not kind. So she's a single mother, had three children back in Honduras, and was very, very afraid that she was going to be sent home. As a matter of fact, she was positive that she was going to go home. She relied on friends who were giving her support, male friends, and these male friends were fired, and almost one by one. And the more she saw them fired, they were scared she was because she was not getting anybody, any support. She was by herself and this person. So I was, we were very concerned because once you are at sea, you're vulnerable. Somebody asks you to go to their cabin, and what can you do?
Especially when your friends are kind of arbitrarily dismissed. There was a sudden inspection of the lockers, and they randomly picked the lockers of these two guys, and in their lockers they found some equipment that had been issued to them. And it was the kind of thing where everybody, you know, technically the rules are when the equipment is issued at the end of every shift, you bring it back. But nobody did that because it was a cumbersome procedure. So they just kept it in their locker and they used it again the next door. Well, that became the excuse then for sending these guys home. And then the woman thinks, you know,
obviously. They were known to be supporters of this woman.
They were her close friends, and they were the ones telling her, go and talk with Maria, and it's, you know, you don't have to sleep with this captain just because he calls you to his cabin.
Right. So, and also, a woman from Honduras might not have the aggressiveness or the assertiveness that we or some women have in these countries, in our countries. And we know how the law works, and we can challenge him and say, you're not doing right. But a person who is out of her context is much more vulnerable. And there she was. What we did was to call, we knew an attorney for the company that represents her ship. And we called him up and told him that, hey, you better take care of this business or the media might know. And this could be a good media sensation case that would harm them a lot.
We kind of said to him, look, nobody wants to make bad news for your ship, because we care about all the people working who have jobs on that ship. But you know that in our society, a story like this would just be, the newspapers would pick it up so fast.
So she was changed to another ship. She was transferred to another vessel, and I hope that she also needed some advice about how to dress, but women sometimes get disoriented by all the flashing life at sea and all these ships, and they see other women that wear mini skirts and they want to kind of copy the style because it's very chic or something. But the injustice and the abuse was done nevertheless how she was dressing.
Nothing happened to the officer?
We're not sure. I mean, I want to think that the attorneys, they got enough information from us to know who needed to be talked to.
But the officer is a staff captain, is from Greece, and they've been for many, many years, and they run the ship like if it was their home. So for the company, it's a little sensitive to accuse them of that and race. But maybe they can give... This example can be, the company can set up rules or exercise more these lines of behavior.
Do I take in the conversation we've had so far that the ships in no way have a listing of their crew? Going back again to that first where you're trying to obtain information as to who was on that ship that perished, so you can start tracking down the families. You know, on an airplane, if something goes down, eventually not too long afterwards, you have a list of the people who were on that plane.
You have a list of the names, and we have that list, but we don't have the... We just have a name, and how can you find a family in Guyana by a name? Or in Indonesia?
You need the cooperation of the company. And in the case of a plane crash, when ValuJet crashed in Miami recently, ValuJet company immediately published information about who was on that, and also it's, you got families coming forward because it's all over the media. In this case, you're talking about survivors who go months at a time without contact with their loved one anyway. So they don't suddenly know that their loved one is missing and come forward and ask questions and say, by the way, this is my phone number and how you can reach me.
Yes.
You mentioned the ship that sank was, the offices are in Miami. Is that a domestic
yes.
company? Or did they shelter themselves by registering the vessels elsewhere?
Yeah, we mentioned this yesterday. I don't think you were here. That today it's typical that a U.S. ship owner will fly a flag of convenience rather than the state flag. Wouldn't fly the U.S. flag on that ship, but would fly the flag of Panama or Liberia or Cyprus or Belize to avoid tax laws and labor laws.
And that's, and Wall Street likes that.
There's very few, U.S. flag is a fast diminishing breed. There are very few U.S. flags left. It's just much cheaper, economically, it's much cheaper to run a ship with a foreign flag than it is with a U.S. flag. So there's very few flags that still, and for that reason, the U.S. Merchant Marine is virtually dead. The people who work on the U.S. ships, U.S. flagged ships, can earn good money, but there are very few of those jobs left.
Well, it's more than just jobs. It's what the port of call, it's Jones Act law, it's maritime law that allows foreign vessels to be more competitive.
Right.
Union contracts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, that's happening in all industries now. It's getting international, so that responsibility gets shifted out of the country for a lot of what goes on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Globalization of the economy.
Mm-hmm. I guess shipping was just there 100 years earlier.
So finally, there is an example of illnesses and accidents that they happen a lot, especially on cruise ship, as people, crew members are not formally trained. They might come from the countryside in Honduras or in Guatemala, and then all of a sudden they start working on an environment that is mobile, and they have to carry long heavy weights, and this ground is floating and moving, and suddenly they strain their back. Or they've been asked to work with chemicals, with cleaning materials over and over in close quarters, and those fumes can affect their noses or their eyes. So we had this Guatemalan crew member who was complaining about this pain in his nose because he had been asked to work in a bathroom with these chemicals, and was asked to see a doctor, went to the clinic, and was asked to come for observation next time they were in port. So this gives the report to the doctor on board. And again, he was convinced that was going to be sent home without the proper medical care. Next week, we have a collect call from the same man. He was already in Guatemala. He had been disembarked in Costa Rica and was concerned that his medical treatment, what was going to happen, that he might need surgery. He was not feeling well.
Coughing blood, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. That if he needed an attorney to be sure that the medical care was going to be continued in back home. So it's not always easy to reach them because they live in far remote areas without phone, but the lawyers in Miami are very well equipped and have assistance in Central America or South America or all around the world, actually, to meet these crew members. So he was visited by one, I think, one of these lawyers. And we don't know what was the story now, what happened, but our job is to make connections, be sort of bridges between the seafarers and the community that might serve or might help them with their needs.
In a cruise ship environment where you've got five, six, maybe in the largest ships, 900 crew members on board, if someone is sick or injured, they have the right to see a doctor. In fact, it's a principle of the maritime industry that while in the employment of the company, the crew member is guaranteed medical care, supposed to receive medical care. So you're working on a cruise ship. As I understood this story, the crew member was forced to clean bathrooms, and he's told by his supervisor to keep the doors closed because he's using heavy bleaches, and that doesn't smell nice for the passengers who are walking back and forth on the hallway. So he's forced to work without ventilation with intense concentrations of bleach, and eventually this wears down the tissue lining, and he starts coughing blood. He goes to see the ship's doctor. It's serious enough that the doctor refers him to a clinic on land. And so when the ship comes in every Saturday, this guy goes and sees a doctor on land. The doctor on land says, I want to see you back again next week. I'm concerned about this. He now gets worried, talks with his friends. They say, go see Maria at the Siemens Center. He comes in, talks to her. What we've learned, the first thing we say to these people is, she gives him her card and says, listen, if anything ever happens, you can call me, collect, at this number or my home number any time of day. We've gotten calls at 3 o'clock in the morning from a Filipino at Heathrow Airport in London who's on his way home to the Philippines and he thinks he's been fired unjustly. But it's very important that there be that communication link to somebody. So the guy gets put off the ship the very next week in Costa Rica, given what, $500 or something like that, and told go home to Guatemala and get some medical care. And because he had made the contact with us and he knew how to reach us, he called Maria. She immediately he wanted an attorney. We don't push attorneys on people, but if they ask for them, that's one of the things that she does. So she linked him up with an attorney who established a fax connection, got the permission to represent this individual, and now a case goes forward. Can I mention the tort reform issue at this point?
Mm-hmm.
Would come in really well. There is in the, I think we alluded to it yesterday, in the freshman congressman in the House last year, with support from the cruise industry, included an obscure provision in the Coast Guard Authorization Act called Cruise Vessel Tort Reform. And the way they're selling this to the public is the cruise companies say that in this litigious society of ours, they're just fed up with all the passengers who get on a cruise ship and slip on a slippery deck or something like that and hurt themselves and then start suing the company. And so they've gone to Washington and said, we need protection from all these passengers in the United States who sue us. But now that part of the bill I'm not speaking to. I don't have an opinion on that. What poor chaplains have taken a very strong position on is the fact that crew members are included in this. And the effect of the bill, which passed the House and did not pass the Senate and is now mired in a conference committee where they're trying to work out a compromise version between the two, the effect of this bill would deny foreign seamen access to U.S. courts, a right which they have had for hundreds of years, literally. It would mean that this Guatemalan man is being told by the United States, even though you're a partner in our economy, you're working in one of our industries, back and forth in our port, if you have a claim because of an injury or because of back wages or any of these things we're talking about, then if you're a foreigner, you should seek redress in your own country. So this guy should go home to Guatemala and try and find the legal support in Guatemala to make a claim against his cruise company, which is based in the United States but flies the flag of Panama. And I point this out. I mean, I don't think that, I'm sure that, well, I know that Carnival Cruise Lines has lobbied very heavily for this bill. I would guess that what allowed such a large number of congressmen in the House, congresspeople in the House, representatives to vote for it was that phrase, foreigners. That we just got to draw the line on how much we can offer foreigners in our society. And what bothers me about that is that seafarers are partners in our local economy. They may be foreigners, but they are very critical to how our economy works. It isn't right to use them for their cheap labor to help make our society rich and then deny them access to the courts, which ensure that when there is a bad apple, and you know, we're only focusing on the problems today, but there are very responsible lines and companies that basically play by the rules. The rules are tough, you know, $300 a month for a hard working job, but they do include some medical care and things like that.
Actually, that's the forest for the trees. There is some truth in the fact that we have a very litigious society, and we are now beginning to eat ourselves alive. The solution is not to penalize the foreign sailors. The solution is to carry reasonable tort reform throughout the entire society, throughout the medical. I mean, they're killing medicine. Yeah. Mm-hmm. They're killing local production of products. So the real thing is to get reasonable, just tort reform. And that message needs to go out to all of Americans, right?
That's right. And I wouldn't argue with that at all. But I will argue against...
Well, all of our people in Congress are lawyers. So.
And I don't think that all of them have time to research heavily every tiny little provision that gets buried in these bills. But they look, you know, a keyword like foreigners jumps out, and in this current climate, that makes it easy to support it. And that's where we have a concern. Mm-hmm.
So the base, why do we do that? Why do are responding to these cases that many people might think, why do you get into politics where this is a job for an attorney or a paralegal or the church? You're going too far. So I believe that God answers our prayers. Prayers, in Spanish we have a word for prayers that is oración, means pray and action. It's all together. So it's a way of, I think God answers our prayers, that we have to act, be active in that in what we are praying. We shouldn't expect, or at least I don't expect, that the answers just suddenly show up, but it's on the doing, on the living, that I find the answer. And I see that Jesus was involved in politics, sort of. He was defending the poor and the oppressed, and the strangers and the lowly. Let me remind you a passage that we read in Matthew. It says, "Then the righteous will answer him, Lord, when was it that we saw you hungry and gave you food, or thirsty and gave you something to eat? And when was it that we saw you a stranger and welcomed you, or naked and we gave you clothing? And then when was it that we saw you sick or in prison and visited you?" And the king will answer them, "Truly, I tell you, just as you did it to one of the least of these who are members of my family, you did it to me." So this is a good reminding that that we ought to work with God towards peace and justice, and make this world better, so the kingdom is here and now, no afterlife, and that's what I believe.
And it's no accident that poor chaplains get forced into this work, because we're literally the only ones that see some of these abuses. You imagine these people coming in and out of the ports and completely strangers in our society. The only ones who see them are the agent who comes on board representing the owner, maybe who's sitting in Greece and has wired money, and the agent is responsible for the local business of that ship in the port, comes on board and talks to the captain, and the port chaplain who goes on board and visits the ship. So that to say that the church should not be involved in these kinds of problems that that the seafarers have would be asking port chaplains to come on board, meet people who are desperately struggling with questions about where to turn for help, and actually say, well, I'm here to preach the gospel, and that doesn't have anything to do with solving your problems. So we take the position quite strongly that seafarers' rights is, as we said yesterday, we did a whole session on all the other stuff we do, the phone calls and the letters and the counseling and the helping them get their money back home and the chapel services and the Bibles and the devotionals. But it's also very important that we give major attention, and we do that by our whole staff being trained to look and listen for these problems, and as soon as we find them, get them to Maria, who's on call. Even when she was on maternity leave and at home, she did a lot of this work from home, 24 hours a day, and we've developed such a strong reputation for it that we get calls from all over the place now. She recently got a call from a port that we don't really work in, and the guy had a problem, and at one point she said to him, well, how did you know to call me? And he said, oh, before I left home in Colombia, my friend who used to be a seafarer told me if I ever get in trouble...
Call Maria.
He's exaggerating.
I missed yesterday, but is port chaplain, is that a... funded by ELCA?
The ELCA puts some money into port chaplaincy. We haven't figured out how to get any of it yet. we're working on that.
Your seafarer's house hasn't gotten any ELCA.
No. We get money from some local Lutheran churches that support us. We haven't gotten any ELCA money. There are a couple of missions around the country that have a long history of being identified as a Lutheran mission. Ours is an ecumenical one. I'm a Lutheran pastor, but it's an ecumenical agency. And these days it's very tough for new agencies to get funding. The church is saying, well, we're trying to continue the ministries that we've already invested in, but there isn't funds for expanding it. So I did a session last week called Doing More Ministry with Less Money. It's on tape if you want to listen to it. And talked about our philosophy of how we're going to start new ministries in this age of tight funding. And basically we decided not to be embarrassed about involving ourselves with the economy of the people we want to serve. So we looked at the seafarers, said they're earning money, most of them, if they're getting paid, are earning some money. They spend, where do they spend that money? And we found out that they spend more money on phone calls than anything else. Just staying in touch with their families was a huge chunk of their personal budget. So we now do that in a big way and help them make those calls cheaper than they have any other access to making it. But as soon as you involve yourself with people's money, you also generate, there's a margin, if you do it from a smart business point of view, there's a margin there that helps cover your overhead. That's one source. The International Transport Workers Federation has a trust fund in England that makes grants to support port chaplaincies, to support the capital needs. So they won't put money into salaries or daily budgets, but they will help buy a van or a building or something like that. So I would take one more question from Barb, and then I would point you toward the tape last week on doing more ministry with less money for how we get funded, or the tape yesterday, A Church in the Workplace, for what other kinds of things we do, or the literature on the back of the table. There's plenty of it there. And we wanted to pass this out, which comes from the Institute for Mission at Trinity Seminary in Columbus, Ohio, excerpt of an address made by Wayne Stummey, who is very concerned about to a group of port chaplains in March.
Do any owners try to prohibit your access to the ships?
Or conversely, are there any owners who are happy to have you come aboard because they see that you are, that these are important areas, or is it somewhere in between? I mean, have you been blocked?
No, it's free. You have to, we can go up the gangway and
do. The law says that you can, or they have to permit you to
well,
go up?
Well, usually the, you can see some announcements or notice on the ship that it says no visitors are allowed, but you can omit that. It's generally accepted that port chaplains go on the ship, and we have never had any problem.
Well,
and for our volunteers. And
she's exaggerated.
No.
There is a, let me remind
once,
you
once
about the owner of a ship who got a message. Yeah, we'll close with a prayer here in a second. But there was an owner who got a letter from the Center for Seafarers' Rights in New York saying, port chaplains in Florida have complained about your treatment of crewmen. Now, our gripe was with the people who wrote that letter. What actually happened was the crew members came to us. We knew the line. It was a very poorly managed line. Crew members had a tough time. And she recommended that they contact the Center for Seafarers' Rights. Well, their policy is they wanted to protect the crew member, so they exposed us, and they weren't smart enough to realize that this ship only calls at one Florida port. So they weren't exactly disguising us. And in any event, we hadn't contacted them directly, so we had a gripe about that. But he came into our center just livid. With how we were destroying his family's ability to make a living and giving him such a bad reputation. And his ship was well managed, and he has at times forbid our visitors from entering his vessel. We still have a strong relationship with the crew members, but it's a tough situation. That is the exception, and Marie's right. Most of the time we can freely board.
And they are supportive of your ministry, okay?
We're trying to help them convince them that we make the place a better port. A few, the bad apples are not supportive, and they're very defensive about us. Most of the people play by the rules. The Port Authority has decided that we definitely improve the port, and so they get behind us now and do a golf tournament. If any of you'd like to buy a $5 raffle ticket for a free cruise, we'll take your name and address and send them to you next month when they come up. Now that raises $20,000 in a day for us. And we're working on some other strategies to ask the local port industry to help support us. We want to be there representing the churches, but at this point, the best support we get from the churches is volunteers, which is the best kind of support you can get. We'd like to add a little bit more money to that, but it'll take time. We've only been there for 5 years, and we've gone from one employee to 20, so we've grown real fast, and we're excited about what's there. But it needs more work. We'll close with a prayer now. What we didn't do today that I would urge you, if you don't have time to listen to the whole tape yesterday at Church in the Workplace, just listen to the last 5 or 10 minutes about what seafarers offer us. Now, we've been talking about the help we offer them. They are a terrific resource to us. And I won't repeat all that
now.
I will make after the prayer. I'll make a commercial for tomorrow.
Liberating God, we give you thanks today for bringing us together to reflect, share ideas, study at this time. We pray that you give us thankful hearts to share with others our gifts, especially those gifts that might serve to empower the needy ones, the ones at disadvantage. We pray for courage and wisdom to make this world better. And we are grateful for being here today. We pray in Jesus' name.
Amen.
Thank you for coming. Tomorrow, some of you know that I used to live in South Africa and was very involved in talking about South Africa for a long time. Since the last time I was at Holden, I got involved in media production and a film that was nominated for an Academy Award as Best Documentary 2 years ago about Beyers Naudé, the Afrikaner church leader in South Africa, who's one of my personal mentors and heroes. We'll show a videotape at 3:45 tomorrow afternoon about this great man of the faith who involved himself politically, and then talk in discussion about whether that's part of the church's role or not.